ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Rabia Dilan Long. She's an executive coach to some of the most senior leaders in industry and a management consultant to some of the most prestigious organizations in the world. She's also the co-founder of the Monarchs Collective, a business launched to change the complexion of business by making it easier to discover, develop, and promote female and BIPOC talent on corporate boards and in senior leadership. Rabia, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
We've known each other for years, and I've always followed your career as the stealth secret weapon, making businesses and individuals unlock the best of what they have to offer. So I was really excited when I learned about this venture, the Monarchs Collective, which is not in stealth mode, that you're launching with Deborah Lee, another powerful female force of nature. She's the former leader of BET, who helped make it the first African-American company that was traded on the New York Stock Exchange and played a lead role in its acquisition for $3 billion by Viacom. So there are so many things I want to ask. But first, for people who might not be aware of what the Monarchs Collective is and why it came into being, could you give listeners a high-level description of the business need that you saw and then how the Monarchs Collective addresses it?
Sure. Thank you very much. It's an exciting time for American businesses to recognize the power of stakeholder capitalism and to move beyond what we traditionally think of as shareholder value. That's why we're in business. And I'd worked with Deborah Lee for maybe 8-10 years when she was running BET, as you said, and it really is a remarkable transformation story from syndication to original content and so on. And as she retired, she thought, what's my next act? She'd been deeply involved with something called Leading Women Defined, which is an independent organization that networks about 100 very powerful Black female executives around the country. And she was doing that. And as we were talking in the spring and summer of 2020, it occurred to us that things had reached a serious inflection point. And it was really on the heels of the George Floyd killing that we said, what are we doing? We've been watching business for so long. We've seen what works. We've seen what doesn't. There's a business case for this, and there's the right thing to do. Let's do something about it. And for so many years, we've been hearing, oh, so-and-so is looking for a diverse candidate, almost as a check the box thing. And we thought, you know, we know a lot of people, we understand business, let's come together, combine networks and see what we can do together.
It's such an important issue for consumers, for everyone, and one that people are paying attention to, especially younger generations are really noticing who's taking action, and it will affect their brand and buying decisions. So it's interesting, important, doing
exactly
good.
Right. I think everyone came out in summer 2020 with some nice PSAs and some statements. But when the younger generation did go to look at the social media and the websites to look at board composition and management teams, they were like, something's not lining up. And I actually just had a potential client decline to proceed with an interview when she looked at the board of directors of an organization. She said, I do best working with diverse groups, and I don't think they're ready for me yet. And so I tried to explain to her the journey. But she was like, no, I'm going to work over here where I know they've already taken steps to make significant and demonstrable change.
That's so interesting. So listening to you and knowing about both of your careers, there are two things that really jumped out at me as differentiators for the Monarchs Collective. And those things were both you and Deborah have board experience. And the second thing was that you're not selling recruitment of diverse candidates. You're selling a holistic assessment of each enterprise's particular needs and challenges, and then crafting a bespoke approach to meet those needs. And so it isn't about a transactional filling of positions with diverse candidates, but creating real and lasting impact through diversity and adjustment of the corporate ecosystem, if you will. So, but first, do diverse boards really perform better?
100%. We know that they perform better. They perform better when they have more women, particularly in equal amounts, and they perform better when there is representation that begins to reflect the communities that are being served by the organization. Think about media companies. Who watches the most television? We know who they are, and they're Black females of a certain age category. Who's making the programming decisions? It's usually the white men of a certain age category.
Really? How in touch are they?
Deborah has a story of when she won the Revlon board, these all these men getting excited about lip color. And she's like, do you guys even know anything about lip color and what women are looking for? So I think it's important to be able to reflect the diversity of the communities that you seek to serve. But I also think it's important to be able to recognize that American business is really meant to be not just creating shareholder value, but long-term value. And that means not always being guided by what's the most expedient solution, but what is the right solution. And that is to think about the communities in which you are operating and how you want to see that interaction happen in the longer term.
Right, right. So important. So in addition, though, to the board experience, you have a rich consulting experience. How has your consulting experience influenced how you're approaching this challenging task?
So I think we're both sort of monogamous. Deborah was in her organization for almost 30 years, and I've been doing mine for almost 23.
So, that's unusual these days.
We're into long-term relationships. And so for me in consulting, it's similar long-term relationships, not just based on I have a problem, come and solve it and go away, but really thinking about how to understand the whole ecosystem of the organization and be able to affect the different drivers that will help the organization make better decisions and therefore have better outcomes. And so for me, consulting back in the day, it was what's the problem we're solving for? You know, what's underneath it? Where do you want to go? And what are the gaps? And so for me, even if it's coaching or consulting, it's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. What are you striving for? And so I think the difference here as we approach the market, and we've had a really lovely reception from organizations, actually in multiple countries, is to say, are you just trying to adhere to a new expectation, or do you truly want to have a holistic look at how you're operating? Because there are a lot of things that affect the feeling of diversity, equity, inclusion, or belonging, as some organizations call it. Are you thinking about the traditions, the customs, the rituals that you have in your organizations that may preclude you from bringing in the right people, or even when you do, helping them be successful once they're there? I think there's two pieces of it, and we don't always pay attention to both. And then sort of binding that together is, what is the organization doing to be ready for these new folks to come in with new perspectives and new ways of thinking and behaving and deciding?
Right, of course. And so this is where I think also your board experience, Deborah's own board experience, shape things. So obviously there's the Revlon story where she has the ability to say, hello, gentlemen, how much lipstick are you wearing? But how else has your experience in that room, in those conversations, how is that shaping things in terms of the conversations you're having?
Yeah, thank you. So Deborah's on the board of AT&T, Burberry, Procter & Gamble, and Marriott. I'm on the board of two nonprofits, and she's got a bunch of nonprofits, too numerous to name. So I'll give you examples that aren't related to any of those organizations. But I will say that, I guess a little of my story. The first time I went to a board meeting as a board member, I was really struck by being on that side of the table. I was used to being the person facilitating the board development and having them ask the hard questions of themselves. I got in the room and I realized if the group never asked those questions of themselves with, I mean that not just about DEI stuff, I mean that with what is their duty? What are their roles? What are their expectations? How are they delivering for each other and for the organization? They're not always so thoughtful about their own board effectiveness. So I went to my first meeting and I realized that if you don't know how to navigate those kinds of rooms, you get invited in, but there's no way to sort of talk, interject, ask a question, shift the conversation, disagree. It becomes very much a groupthink experience because you don't want to be the outlier. And so I sort of shook things up. I was provocative. I'm like, okay, you can run the October retreat. So I ran this October retreat.
Of course you did.
And I was like, listen, we're all humans here and let's talk about what we want to be, because really a board is a team. And anytime you add a person to a team, it reshapes the entire team. But if you don't take a beat and recognize it, you just keep going with your patterns, like a dance. You know, you would dance with your partner. You have the same record every night. What's for dinner? I don't know. I'm tired too. Fine, let's not eat together at all. We have these patterns with each other. And so breaking them is really important to be able to get to those new ways of thinking, new ways of problem solving, because the conditions, the challenges that we're facing, they're not new, but the brains that we're bringing to the table have coming up with some pretty astonishing new ideas that get better in collaboration with other people. But if people are holding back for fear of being judged or being seen as less than or not deserving of that space, then we really suboptimize the whole group experience.
Right. It's about sort of unlocking the benefit of including the people, of inviting them into the room having a way to unlock that insight and different diversity of experience and background, which is sort of linked to something I've heard in interviews. Deborah's mentioned that it isn't about adding one candidate, that two is important now. So what's the difference? Why does it matter? Why does the number that you want more than one? Why is two something to mention?
So we've literally been in rooms where we'll be talking about something and then someone will ask on the board, what's the impact on the female consumer or the African-American consumer or the Hispanic consumer? And all heads swivel to the one person who might look like the person or the category that they're talking about. And so I think it's very hard to be the first and the only. And so we have this idea that as boards are seeking to compose their groups, they're thinking about education, geographic experience, industry experience, domain knowledge, all those things. But it should also include how they solve problems and what they've seen. Have they done turnarounds? Have they done startups? Have they run mature companies? What are those different levels of experience? So when you come together, you're richer for it. And so I believe bringing in two or more people that do seem different is critical, because when you add one to a group, it's like, okay, and then you become that one, either the only or the first. But if you do it in pairs, there's sort of strength in numbers, so that you're not the only one saying the point of view from that underrepresented demographic group. And so it is nice, I think, to have some strength in numbers that way, and it makes you feel more confident. And I think it gives you some ballast also when you're in committees to be able to talk to people in a real way where you can just be yourself and talk authentically versus always having to code switch and adapt to the majority of the room.
Right. That's so interesting. And the psychology of it, both the people themselves, but also the other people in the room, which relates to my next thought, was really one of the things I love is that you're an equal opportunity trainer. You're offering to help these diverse candidates be prepared to be effective board members. But hand in glove with that, you're talking to the existing board members about how to effectively onboard and unlock that stuff. Is that something that happens? Are they all in one group? Do you separate them out? Do you prep them before you bring it? How does that even work? I mean, or is it an ongoing training?
Well, I think there's different groups. So I think there's at the earliest level, the most nascent level of potential population would be those people who think, I have worked really hard. I'm an expert on supply chain, global companies. I deserve to be seen and be considered for a board, but I haven't yet served on any nonprofit board or other public board. So that's to me the most nascent, the person who displays great insights and leadership and abilities, but hasn't had the training. They didn't go to MBA school. They didn't get that training or that exposure. All the way through to people that are already being considered or have just joined or are current board members. And it's interesting across the spectrum, a lot of board members actually never had formal board training. Many boards were formed because of relationships. It's a kind of a who's who of private clubs or universities or consulting firms. So I think my and Debbie's aim is to create to reduce some of the friction and finding these folks and to make sure that they have the competence and the confidence to do what they do best. And so I do think there are discrete ways of addressing the different levels of people because they have different needs. But in all cases, the idea would be to create a feeling of community, particularly as you're earlier in the process, because then you can share tips and ideas. You can, if someone calls you and asks you, do you want to join, this organization that's not right for you or you're overboarded, you can share it with someone else. But to create more groups of mass so that they can begin to feel like there is a support structure in place for them, because peer mentoring is just so important. When it comes to the current board, I try not to call it training, but more development. Because it's like coaching, 20 years ago, everyone's like, oh, you need coaching. No, coaching's not always remediation. Coaching's actually like having a nutritionist or a physical trainer about getting better. So I think those boards that recognize that they have a fiduciary duty, but they also have an opportunity to come together and be more productive as a team. Meetings can be shorter, more efficient, more focused if they are really united about what they stand for and what their obligations are to the organization. And that also does include their commitments to creating a diverse, equitable, and inclusive environment. That goes back to that stakeholder capitalism. Who are we serving? Are we always being mindful of those that we serve, particularly in public companies where everyone is always focused on their quarterly results and being judged so publicly? It's easy to fall into that trap of thinking in a very short-term way. The board is meant to be helping us say, look up and don't forget, there's a longer horizon here, and are we building for the future? What about succession at the CEO level? What about succession in the C-suite? And what about succession of our board members? Some board members have been with us for a long time, and maybe there are others who bring new ways of thinking and new expertise that we might need in this ever-changing world.
Right. Oh, yes. So many things there. It even strikes me that boards that have already become have diverse candidates may want to think, are we as effective as we could be? So this is something that really applies across the board, really. You know, I'm using board an awful lot in that sentence, but they could benefit. I think when I think about the landscape of who currently plays in this space, nobody is really integrating all of these things. Nobody has this holistic approach, or at least I'm not aware of them. I mean, I know about sort of the recruiting end of things. And then, there's unconscious bias training, forgive the word. I agree with you that people look at that and feel it's remediation. But how, when you're talking to potential clients or now when we're doing an interview, how is it different? How is it different from that, like from unconscious bias conversations?
Unconscious bias is really interesting. And I'm sure you've done the New York Times test. I mean, they're really interesting to see, in an unguarded way, how do you really respond on that keyboard? Because it really betrays how your mind works. And I think it's interesting, but they've also been criticized for not necessarily leading to changes in our behavior. They may increase awareness, but not change our behavior. I think the difference in terms of training per se on unconscious bias is that we tend to think in terms of a theoretical. And what we know, and this goes all the way back to work we did together many years ago, when we did a lot of post-merger integration, we know that humans are tribal. And we tend to gravitate towards those who are like us. They look like us. They think like us. They have similar backgrounds. That's comfortable for us. That's safe for us. When we go to these trainings, I think in some ways it's almost like in an us versus them. And let us help you decipher that so that we can help it become demystified for you. When in fact, Debbie and I are in an unusual situation because we are sitting on boards. We have these relationships. So when we talk about it, it's coming from a place of experience, but also we're talking about the people that we probably know. So let's say we are bringing a new member or two into a board. When you're preparing the board to embrace this new person, it's not a reminder, writ large, be open-minded. Don't let your brain take shortcuts and do things that are unintentionally biased. But instead to say, this is Joe Smith or Jill Smith, and they're coming in, and it becomes personal. And I think we can affect change. Personal thing. It's not that's not me. I'm not like that. I'm open-minded. I have a friend who's Black. It's very much, this is going to be this new colleague of yours. How are you going to work with this new colleague? And can you see what they're bringing that goes beyond those external factors that you can see superficially? So I do think that that focus on the individual assimilation will be different than the group experience of anti-bias or unconscious bias.
And right. And it's so tailored. So it's very, very, very specific.
It's tailored, but it's also taking it to the personal level. It's very hard to be rude to someone, sitting around even a virtual boardroom table when you have gotten to know them as a human versus, hey, by the way, when you meet someone who doesn't look like you, be nice to them. It just feels different, I think, to be rooted in a person.
Right. You know?
I think the other thing is recruiting firms, which you mentioned, and who also do a lot of unconscious bias training. I feel like they're really good at having a database of people and their relationships with the organizations are deep, but they tend to be transactional to say, your CMO is leaving. We have some candidates for you versus we know you really well. And so we see that there might be a change and we're being proactive and thinking when a change happens, here are some ideas about how you can configure your team to reflect more closely the demographics that you serve. So thinking about it from a more planful way versus a reactive way to putting and that transaction of dollars for that.
Right. That's really interesting. So thinking about who your clients are. Your clients are enterprises or individuals?
I think ultimately it's both. The groundswell of questions and queries from individuals who are saying, thank goodness you exist. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to even get considered for this board. I didn't know how to get trained for it. I'm so excited, is one bucket that I'm very excited to explore because I do think there's a huge potential there. And on the other side are organizations that have already articulated a commitment to making change. And I think if we could work with some of those organizations to create new ways of thinking about some of these older problems in a holistic way, we can then go back and then bring those potential candidates along, and it sort of works in a nice synergy. But I think to be able to have that enterprise-wide work where we can really demonstrate the value of the work and have people really become ardent proponents for this is the way to sort of change the mindset that hopefully will then create even more opportunities for new candidates to raise their hands.
Right, right. So how does an engagement work? If I'm an enterprise and I reach out to you, what does that first conversation look like? I say, oh, I heard your interview. So how do you structure your work?
Well, I think the question you started asking is, what's the conversation sound like? And it is very much an exploratory conversation about what it is you're seeking, why you're seeing it, why now? Because those why questions help us understand how authentic the interest is, because we don't want to do just the performative stuff. And once we go, okay, yeah, I can see you really are generally committed to this, then the question is, and what is it you think you're solving for? And what does success look like to you? And what do you not have at your fingertips, either in-house or outside, that we could fill a need for? So trying to understand what is in place, what's missing, so that we can then prioritize how we go about doing things. In any good work, I think there's always an assessment. You hear in that intake meeting a lot of articulated wants and needs, but it's really helpful to talk to a few other people to triangulate that and ensure that that is a shared view, not just one person's articulation of the view. But once you have a shared view, then to say, how are we prioritizing and what should we do first? And so to be able to do some sort of current state assessment to see, where we are. And oftentimes it's better, but it's usually less good. less rosy, I'll say, less rosy. It's not about shame. It's really about how do we do the best possible problem solving? And having done this work for a long time, I know that very often, affirmative or appreciative inquiry is the best way to go. What's working well, and being positive, but also holding up a mirror to say, well, you say you want this, but here are some decisions you've just made. These are not congruent. Let's talk about how we're going to go about fixing that. I think the other thing to do is to make sure that it's not an HR initiative. It's a leadership initiative, because if it's owned by HR, it just often becomes devalued or seen as the flavor of the day, the campaign of the year. And this needs to be an ongoing, perpetual process of identifying what we're doing well and could do better to find, keep, develop, and promote people who really bring interesting perspectives and new ways of solving these problems to bear.
Right. Well, that actually gets to one of the next thoughts I was having is often the people who are reading literature about this, thinking about this, are in the HR group, or they're in the, diversity sourcing group, or they're in a group that is often an overhead cost center. And so what kind of conversation should they be having to help sell the idea in to senior leadership? How do they do that?
I think it depends on the culture of the organization. I think some organizations would respond well to a risk-based pitch, which is, guys, it's coming. You want to get your house in order. Otherwise, you're going to not be in compliance, or it won't look good to your consumers or stakeholders. Mm-hmm. There's that risk-based look. I prefer the more positive approach, which is, this is an opportunity. And as we seek to build value for the long term, here are some opportunities that we have to recast how we go about making decisions and doing business. And it usually starts with how we hire, promote, and pay people. And are we looking at those things in concrete ways? So I tend not to look at it as dollars and cents, because I think in many cases it'll be an investment for organizations to take on this work. But I think that the benefit in the work will become very clear, particularly when we don't just say, here's the problem, but we actually offer solutions that are effective and efficient solutions. HR, and I'm kind of a recovering HR person.
You're never really recover.
I think so. I'm still in recovery. I think you're always looking to solve your internal clients' problems, right? So are the right people in the right seats? Am I getting feedback? Are they developing and so on? And there's a speed factor. For the HR person to slow down and say, you know what, when I deliver candidates for that CMO position or that CFO position, I'm going to make sure that I've got a really representative group of candidates. That takes extra time for the HR person. So how do we make it easier for them to do the right thing? And I've seen this happen.
Oh, so important. So important.
You know, someone leaves and I say, oh, I have candidates from the last search. And I pull out and it's the same, with all due respect, paley pigmented people in that same, you know, folder. So how do we make sure that we beat and take the time to source from new places? And that's not just for senior levels, but that would be, you know, early career as well as mid. I think we're seeing a lot of progress in the early career, but in the mid, not as much. And then senior, there is this perception there's not enough supply, but they're there. They are absolutely there. It's a matter of finding them and making sure that they feel confident and competent to get into that room.
Right. It's that I can't find qualified people, but the fact of the matter is they exist, and it's how you're sourcing them and then how you're preparing them so they're effective.
I think that's right. And I was talking to a very senior person, and he was telling his chief of staff, telling his boss, you know, I see this list of attributes on the profile you're seeking. You're not going to get all of them. There's no unicorn. So what are the most important things? And thinking of it from that frame can help. And that applies to corporate positions, but also to board members. You're never going to find the exact perfect person, but who do you see that has what you need? Other things can be trained, but what do you really need? And that opens up possibilities. You know, for a long time, only CEOs of public companies were considered as viable board candidates. Now organizations are saying, hey, maybe you don't have to have been a CEO of a publicly traded company to be an effective board member. And that opened up a lot of possibilities for women and people of color. I think sometimes organizations that say, we limit board service only to the CEO and his or her direct reports, unwittingly are, you know, perpetuating that systemic challenge.
Well, sure. You're going to create a limiter where you don't appear to be limiting, but you are de facto limiting.
Exactly. Now, make no mistake, an employee's and executive's first obligation is to the organization in their current role. But if we are really serious about developing leadership bench strength, we've got to help people find opportunities to be able to do more. And I think that employees are seeking more meaningful lives. So they do have their work, but it's almost like they have different spheres. It's work and it's family and it's health, exercise, faith. But I think this community sphere is increasingly important to younger people. And if we're not making room for that and acknowledging the value of that, I think we'll see people checking out of the workforce to do other things that are more meaningful to them.
Oh, so interesting. So interesting and so smart. And I can't wait to see how you move forward and the ways in which you help create systemic change. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you. I loved your questions and I look forward to talking with you more.
Excellent. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.